Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm joined by my good friend and confidant, Mike Bellamente. Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Not bad, Aaron. Good to be here.
Thanks for taking the trip down from New Hampshire, coming in for the day to share some thoughts, a bit of your background.
Absolutely. Glad to do it. And there was no traffic, so even easier.
Even easier. Nice enough. Hey, Mike, let me read a bit back or about your background, and then we'll talk about how we first engaged. Sure. and go from there.
Sounds good.
So a few years ago, you were the executive director of Climate Counts and you're head of citizens engagement efforts at CDP. This was an opportunity that allowed you to flourish as a thought leader while helming Gary Hirschberg's Environmental Accountability Organization. And in a bit more background there for our listening audience, gaining traction and attention within huge brands and over 20,000 high-impact followers, Mike Bellamente was a third-party certifier for green and sustainable corporate practices, directly hitting and tapping into the mainstream through the wallets and ideology of consumers who care about this stuff. So, Mike, I've always known you as a high-integrity guy who can galvanize a following. There you go. That's a nice.
Maybe you could tell my wife that.
We'll see if we can work that in later on. Well, she can listen to see what's going on here. But yes, I always known you as that. And let's say that maybe you can tell us a bit more of how you use those skills to instigate environmental change through instituting more values into our buy decisions as consumers.
Yeah, no doubt. And you brought up something interesting with Gary Hirschberg's vision of the engaged consumer and using the power of the purse as a very powerful lever. And the thought was at the time that if we took, this was, keep in mind, right after the IPCC fourth assessment, when it was pretty well written on the wall what we were facing with climate change. And Gary Hirschberg thought at the time, as did I, if we put together a scorecard rating companies on their climate awareness and climate reduction or carbon reduction goals, then consumers would react to that and support the right players. And then the bad actors would, fizzle out. As we all know, it's become kind of a sea of eco labels, certifications, ratings, and obviously here in the States, such a polarizing conversation that we're actually regressing. But the initial idea was to have that conscious conversation with consumers to start thinking about what they were buying and why they were buying it.
Yeah. And what I remember very distinctly about this, and I found very intriguing what we were creating, it was a scorecarding tool, but it gave me one easy way, nice easy assessment to make a declaration, a decision to go with Nike over Adidas or Puma, right? I mean, you basically gave me some real tangible ways to make better buying decisions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think as our guest today, Han de Groot, will agree with, sometimes it takes for a nonprofit the voice of a brand, a multinational brand, to scale that message. So when we'd come out with our scorecard each year, whether it was Nike or Unilever, we'd work with their social media team to say, hey, number one in their sector is Unilever on climate change. And just to hear them tweet it out or have them say something about it would exponentially increase the audience for us. So that was clever marketing is always a piece of that. So Follow the Frog was always one of my favorite campaigns that got done. So
nice. And so our listening audience knows back in 2012, 2011 timeframe, when you're helming some of this, you were nice enough to include me on your board. It was actually one of the reasons I stayed with the whole environmental food movement. So, Mike, you can see me welling up a little bit here.
I
appreciate it, buddy. You really made a big difference. You kept me in it, kept me in the ballgame, because you do have those moments. Everyone has those moments. You start to question, what impact am I having? Is there distinct and correct motion and action of what I'm actually putting into this, and it can become challenging. You got to get up, dust yourself off many times. So I appreciate the support, brother.
Yeah, well, and I wish it'd been an easier road for me as well. I became so disenfranchised with this current administration and with where I was at in my personal life, and I walked away from the sustainability movement for a bit to take a break because it was almost too much. So I'm glad I could be there for you. You've been a great a friend of mine for a long time. So,
well, good stuff. And I don't know what you're talking about this administration. They do all fine stuff in the environment, don't they?
Yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah. Hey, today, so, Mike, as you mentioned, we have a very special guest joining us with significant skin in the game when it comes to this matter of third-party certification and the impact and value of that. We welcome Han de Groot, who's the CEO of Rainforest Alliance. Han, thanks for joining. We appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Hello and good afternoon, Aaron and Mike. Nice to be
good
with
afternoon.
You.
Good afternoon.
So, Han, let me ask you a quick question related to what Mike and I opened with. So the Rainforest Alliance certified seal is awarded to farms, forests, businesses that meet rigorous environmental and social standards. But in an increasingly noisy world, as Mike was alluding to, how do consumers make accurate and just decisions? And maybe you could share with our listening audience why meaningful and impactful third-party certification seals of approval are so important in stabilizing the planet moving forward.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. That's a nice opportunity. What we basically do at the Rainforest Alliance is that we help farmers to use more sustainable agricultural practices. So we train them or get them trained by other parties in more sustainable practice. And once they meet our standard, then the product gets the can carry the seal. So after following the product through the whole supply chain, as you can imagine, it goes from hand to hand to traders and to other traders, to manufacturers, then to the supermarket shelf, people can make a choice. And they can be aware of the seal. In our case, that's the frog seal. This is the small green frog on pack, on hopefully on the front, sometimes on the back. And make that choice. So more and more consumers, they vote with their purchasing behavior and choose for these products. And why, you ask me, why is this important? Well, agricultural supply chains and food production has a huge footprint in the world. You know, we use more and more land for to produce our food. We do that in not always in a very sustainable way. So the climate impact, for instance, is very big. We clear forests to produce even more. And we believe that this is not needed, that we can really make a win-win by having sustainable agriculture and forest protection and also respecting human rights and giving people a decent livelihood.
A big systems thinking approach to this, which is essential as we start to coax these values back through our supply chains. So Han, I want to come back to the evaluation of permacrops and farming, and but I want to start. I'm going to read a bit about your background, and then I'll jump into another question about the vast scale that you've created with Rainforest Alliance. So Han is dedicated to his career to sustainable development. After studying economics at the University of Aachen, he worked for more than 12 years at Oxfam, eventually leading the organization's work in Eastern and Southern Africa. In 1998, Han joined the Dutch government, and from 2005 to 2010, he held various positions at the Ministry of Agriculture, Nature and Food Quality, including the Deputy Director of Nature. So, Han, in reading about what you're up to with Rainforest Alliance, I saw that you operate in over 60 countries all over the globe, and from what I read, your organization has programs focused on sustainable forestry certification, sustainable agriculture certification, crop standards and criteria, Rainforest Alliance certified seal, and sustainable tourism. So how do you keep all this straight with this multinational, huge organization doing great good? How do you get sleep at night?
Yeah. I usually sleep well, but these are pressing issues, and it's complex. You're right. So what is very important that we choose the right partners. And you can look at most of these bigger international supply chains, like the big ones we work in is coffee, bananas, tea, cocoa. They are a little bit structured like an hourglass. So we have millions of small producers, small farmers, thousands and hundreds of traders who buy their produce. Then there are usually just a few parties, you know, who are the big international traders or coffee roasters or chocolate manufacturers. And then, of course, we see more and more hundreds and thousands of retailers and producers who finally bring the end product, the cocoa, the chocolate, the coffee, the tea to the consumer. So we have fairly good relationships with those who are in the middle of the hourglass, you know, where the glass is pretty how you call this narrow, because there are between a handful and maybe 25 big international companies who really make a lot of difference. So we also strongly appeal to them and say, you have a big responsibility given your size. So while our seal is offering the consumer a choice, and then we talk about millions of consumers, because you're right, we work in many countries now. Most of the in most countries in the world, you can find one or more Rainforest Alliance certified products. Now we estimate about 20,000 of them you can find on the supermarket shelves all across the world. So that's a lot, and that you can think, okay, you don't get any sleep anymore. But on the other hand, sometimes it's only a handful of companies that really are substantial, are at the core of these supply chains. And yeah, we appeal to them to work with us. We pressure them. And some are more willing than others, but we find them, those are important stakeholders to our goals.
And Han, just to dig in, and this is Mike, just to dig in a little further on that, I'm assuming that the certification process, it depends or requires the companies to self-report their data and their metrics. Is that the case?
Yes, but that's only the start of it. So we certify farms and groups of farms and smaller and bigger ones. And so, yes, they through their what we call internal management system, they self-report. But every year we send independent auditors to check these. So these audits, that independent certification system is actually the core of our credibility, as you can imagine, sure. Because they need to check and report on that. And, those audits need to match the internal reporting and need to match the criteria of our standard.
So at that point, how difficult is it to hold accountable companies with those tiers two and three upstream suppliers in countries with more lax environmental controls, that hand-to-hand off that you were speaking of earlier? I can imagine there must be a weak link in a chain that long. How do you try to combat that or streamline that?
Yeah. Well, where it all starts is at the farm, at the origin of the supply chain. So we work both with small farmers who are usually grouped in cooperatives.
Yeah, sure.
That's a very important way of accumulation and organizing them. It gives them also more leverage towards traders, for instance. But we also work with the middle-sized and bigger estates. So our sustainable agriculture standard is mostly about that. And the demands we have on the trade and retail is that they buy from these farmers who do an excellent job in producing sustainably, and that supply chain is secured. So we audit them as well on logistics and on administration and on credibility of the chain. And on top of that, we have our own traceability. So they need to report all transactions in our own traceability systems so that we have a critical picture of what the supply chain looks like. Wow, thank you.
it sounds very intensive.
Yeah. Because that's quite intensive. But, you know, IT helps a lot these days.
Big data, yeah.
So of course we need to, and we have, you know, systematize and automize these things. And then that helps a lot, and we are constantly working on renewing that. And meanwhile, we are developing a quite a interesting database, you know, of sustainable farming globally, of where companies source, and who's joining the alliance. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about the technology side, but we're going to ground it in the producers themselves. And in doing some due diligence here, I see that Rainforest Alliance includes farmers and scientists, indigenous communities and governments, and people like you is what's stated in the site. And that's a reference to us. And Mike, I like that type of empowerment message that ties us all into this, right? We're all part of the solution. So one of those stakeholders our listeners will relate to are those farmers, the producers. And I see that you're reimagining your certification system for food production, which includes a new innovative technology system for your SAT for farming project.
Mm-hmm.
I saw in also that after your 2018 merger with OOTS certification, that your standards help 182,000 cocoa, coffee, and tea farmers, and that you're currently certified under, or they're currently certified under both those standards. So could you share a bit more about how this new sustainable agricultural program will tie into your plan to use this advanced technology to advance this essential initiative?
Yeah. I can. Like you said, you know, we focus a lot on the farmer and farmer practices. But we also, over the years, we also discovered that we put a lot of demands on these farmers. And some of them are, many of them are small, many of them are poor, and they have limited means to do this. So we ask a lot. So we realized we need to help them better. And we do that in two ways. One, by training them and developing techniques at this SAT for farming is one. I can explain more about that later. We're developing techniques to really help them to farm better, to have better yields, to produce according to our standard, and to organize themselves. But apart from that help, we also put more focus in the near future on the rest of the supply chain. You know, we need to share the burden. We cannot, we consumers, we companies, we cannot ask millions of farmers to do the job, buy the product, and then be proud of that. We also need to do our part. And that, so we need to pay a decent price. And we need, we also want to engage the supply chain in helping to train these farmers and assist them in becoming more sustainable. And that is what we call reimagining certification. So more sophisticated ways in training farmers and helping them to continuously improve and achieve more impact, but also sharing the burden and make the rest of the world who are stakeholders in this also co-responsible.
Yeah, so a quick follow-up question on that, Han. I love everything about this, the reimagining of the way we consume almost, as well as from the supply chain perspective. One thing I've always grappled with is you have a sustainability program within a very large company like Coca-Cola or Unilever. Unilever, I think, was one of the better ones. They still are, but at integrating, you know, environmental financial incentives into each employee's kind of record. But by and large, your sustainability budget would be a rounding error compared to, say, the marketing budget that helps people buy more things. So at what point do you think it's ever going to be a realistic vision when the by law, the CEO is constricted to improving shareholder wealth by making more products available to consumers to buy? Is there truly ever going to be a net zero or carbon neutrality in the foreseeable future under the capitalist model?
Yeah. $1 million question.
Is it?
Yeah, I don't have the full answer to this. I don't know. Okay. It's I think what we do see, I think, you know, the responsibility for sustainability is coming out of the niche in those companies. So Sometimes in the past, like sustainability was part of the communications department.
Sure.
Yeah. Which suggests actually that you're window dressing, right? Nowadays, we see more often that the purchasing director or vice president is responsible for that. And that's already, I think, a very good step.
Yeah.
So it's not something extra or a rounding error, as you call it, but it's part of sustainable purchasing. You acquire a better product,
Sure.
which is more valued by your clients. So that is a very good step. I'm currently reading the book. I hope it will get an English translation soon, which is a biography of Paul Polman. He's the former CEO of Unilever.
Absolutely love that guy.
About his struggle in the company. And well, I'm halfway, to be honest, so I need to. But I think so far it seems that he has been more successful outside the company. So he's been in, numerous UN commissions. He really rallied many colleague CEOs to do the same. And he had a hard time over his, I don't know, 8 or 10 years with the companies to really get his own colleagues on board, his and his, notably his board, right? His
Sure.
shareholders. Yeah. So I think yeah, it's a little bit also, are you companies, are you willing to look at the short run only and your monthly and your quarterly figures? Or do you have the courage to look a little far, further ahead? And do you want to be in this business in the next generation? A family company sometimes has those values.
Sure.
One of them we also work with is Mars, for instance. It's a family-owned company already for, I don't know, maybe 100 years or a long time, like three, four generations.
Sure.
And so they have shareholders to be accountable to, of course, but these shareholders are a little bit more patient, and they're not listed on a stock exchange, and they look also into, like, I think literally their own children. Will they be in a cocoa business? And I think their answer is yes, and then they need to work on that.
It's I see positive trends there to jump in on this conversation. I mean, what we have seen is more of the rather than shareholder value creation, we're seeing stakeholder value. And this is it seems a lot what you're talking about, Han, is that ability and capacity to then get this on the bottom line of these larger brands, these large enablers that have investors who are looking for things more than just financial returns, these values coaxed into that. And that's from reducing externalities or creating capacity within their supply chains, connecting with a modern consumer. And I think there are trends. I mean, we've seen obviously within the IPCC report that people are now making that correlation, that connection tied from environmental issues and how we are going to feed ourselves moving forward. But even more broad-based things like real cost accounting tied to the SDGs from the UN, those are all very positive steps that get this paradigm shift that returns in the future to be fiduciary responsible to your investors have to include environmental impact. Are you seeing the same thing from these larger players, or are we seeing a trend in that direction, Han, or am I finding too much confirmation bias here?
I see them as well. But you hear the hesitation in my voice. Because I think it takes years, to really get this, make this part of a culture. And that's what you saw, what we see with like Unilever as well. It's not just a new leader that brings better and a good strategy, I think. It's really working on a culture. Staff needs to get used to that. Shareholders need to buy into that and see the positive value. What we sometimes see, for instance, we get a lot of those reports actually, is that when we start working with a company on sustainable supply chain and certify their product, that not only in the market, but also internally, staff is getting much more motivated because they feel proud of their product and of the company they work for. And can you imagine, you know, what the impact that may have by having staff that's really behind on a deeper level, behind what you produce and how you produce it. You know, if that would, would raise productivity with just a few percentage points, that would already have a positive impact on your balance sheet, I think. Leaders in the European Union, for instance, you know, agreed on a climate action plan. So that sets the boundaries, I think, for future production in this case in Europe. So companies who strategize need to look at that. They need to say, okay, those are part of my goalposts in which I have to work. And that's also the way I, as a company, can make my contribution to a better climate.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing that even with ExxonMobil. We need those guidelines so we know how to manage our business going forward. And I think this is kind of geeking out maybe too much, but within the scope of GRI reporting, I know they'd been toying with the idea of implementing a category on context-based sustainability, so science-based targets for each company. So if you are responsible for an eighth of the share of, you know, the sneaker market, then you have an eighth of the share of the carbon budget or something along those lines. Yeah. Do you think is that something that's taken root? Are we starting to see more of this idea of, hey, a 2020 goal, or reduce 15% emissions by 2030, these kind of nice soft numbers that work well in PR releases, I think that is not enough. Do you think that context-based sustainability, it does have a real future in the space?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, yes, if we connect them to the real economy. Mm. So, yes, give it a price. That has been quite a major flaw, for instance, in the carbon trade mechanisms.
Yeah.
Where after Kyoto, in the climate talks, I think we drafted a nice framework to set goals and to have a way of giving carbon the price. But yeah, to put it very simple, the price was too low. It was almost for free. Only recently, I think it started last year, that this price for carbon credits is going up a little bit to more substantial levels. Mm. I think, yeah, it would, you know, it's great if we align around these scientific goals. But the next step is it's report on it. And GRI gives a really is really helpful, I think. And so are the sustainable development goals. But when they really get a price, and carbon now has, I think, the potential to be priced in a substantial way, so that it matters whether you do it or not. Maybe if I can give an example. We worked with coffee farmers to make energy from coffee waste. In the start of a supply chain, a coffee berry, you need to get the bean out of the berry, and that produces a lot of waste and contamination in the water, and it contains a lot of sugar. So that starts fermenting and produces greenhouse gases, methane and CO2. What if you capture that methane and lead it to your kitchen and cook on it? One, you have energy. Two, you reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we hope to stimulate those farmers by giving them gas for the kitchen and a price for the reduced methane emissions. And the product really worked. We did that in Central America, most in Nicaragua. But you know, in those years, the price for a carbon credit that was built into the project was almost zero. So it was very hard to break even for these farmers because they need to make big investment, construct tanks for the waste and it needs a bit of infrastructure to get this working, while the technology itself is pretty simple. So now every time when I see the carbon price go up, I'm becoming more hopeful because I think, hey, now this will be a business case for farmers to be rewarded for this.
Sure.
It's fascinating. It is when you start to look at sustainable agriculture as the best mechanism towards a circular economy. And your example is perfectly that, Han, of actually taking a waste stream from one supply chain or even the direct supply chain and integrating it into solving the problem, another business problem throughout. That's an essential step. And I want to ask, now that you've been an American for 2 years, an interesting 2 years at that, that you've lived in New York, do we have any other market forward aside from doing a cap and trade on if we are going to create a carbon market exchange here in the U.S.?
Yeah, although I live here for 2 years now, I'm still a little bit more familiar with the politics and the economies of the European Union, to be honest.
That's so a good thing. You should be proud of that.
Please share that with us now. Yes.
If you don't mind, I give an example from that side of the ocean.
Sure.
Only a week ago, I think, a number of organizations, and Rainforest Alliance was one of them, we issued a statement to the European Union on due diligence legislation. You know, in the European Union, but, you know, it's not different in the US, you know, the governments have been too long on the fence and saying, well, maybe the business sector can organize themselves for more sustainable ways of production. And companies organized themselves sometimes. Initiatives like ours came up and were very successful. But I'm the first to admit that we are actually filling a vacuum. And that, you know, some of the work in creating a level playing field needs also to be done by legislation. So I think we must develop, and the European Union is now making efforts. That's why we issued this supportive statement to do due diligence legislation and say, hey, for instance, timber that enters the European Union that cannot prove that it comes from legal sources is out. And we don't leave it only to the timber supply chains and companies to organize this, but we have legislations on this. In the United States, there's the Lacey Act, which is a very old bill that regulates some trade. I think that act could be made applicable to more commodities. We have CITES, which is the International Convention on the Trade in Endangered Species. It's already some time ago that I was involved in that, but we then promoted also like through my government, for instance, in the Netherlands government, make a plea for more commercial commodities in those conventions. So the convention tends to focus on you know, really endangered species that that need to be you know, how do you call this, prevented from extinction.
Yeah, sure.
But we should also be very careful that by big volumes of commodities that are traded that maybe will not go extinct, but have a huge impact on the ecosystem. So also those conventions, I think, should become active there. So I think we need more legislation, and governments need to step up.
Well, we would absolutely agree with you there that governments need to step up. It's quite interesting. I actually had the opportunity to study, probably from your workings with the Dutch Ministry of Agriculture. I studied your model on fellowship there in the Netherlands around your Golden Triangle model of using the federal government, the tip of the spear, integrating it with educational resources and then free market. And what I took out of that was to look and realize that in the U.S., I think we're a bit reactionary. Our government players, for many reasons, chase their tail, or they'll chase what the constituents want. So can we use those free markets to instigate change in a different way? Same triangle model, just maybe flipped on its side.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, we are balancing that and realizing that a lot of it stems from the top And we have a lot of capacity built into who's steering the ship in this country. So we have fingers crossed, and maybe we can encourage our listeners to get out there. Make sure we vote. There's a little side note there, right, Mike?
Yep.
Let's get out there and do that. Let me do this, Han, if I could. I want to read one last thought here and kind of get your takeaway on this as we for a last question. So profiled prominently on your homepage is an article around natural climate solutions, which I think is good vernacular that's been more broadly adopted of using natural systems as a way of sequestering carbon and stabilizing the planet. And the quick read describes a bit of your 30-year lineage as an organization that started actually to save the rainforest, but really has evolved with your sights now on saving the planet. And the article describes how healthy forests and proper sustainable agriculture are essential in the future of land management and where we can catalyze and be act as catalysts for climate stability. It seems that the centralized around stewardship of land and forests with unique focus on tree health and how that can be exercised in diverse markets. So with all of that and kind of closing out our conversation, is there hope from your point of view? Are we doing this the right way? And how can we do this better in looking at, we got, maybe within a generation here, if we don't get it right, we're in tough shape. So, yeah. You know, can you give us a hopeful message here to our listeners of get out there and be part of the solution?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I really believe that these natural climate solutions give us a lot of hope. And why is that? One, as the IPCC has told us, you know, they are more than a third of the climate solution. So it's really big. Secondly, at the moment, we only spend very few resources on it. So there's a huge potential to increase. By stepping up a little, we probably have a big impact. And the main thing that gives me hope is that these climate solutions, in other words, you know, do better land use, stop deforestation, have healthy forests, integrate agriculture with forestry and agroforestry, and have sustainable agriculture, you know, that whole collection of things. The most important thing, I think, is it is a proven solution. So we know that it works. You can see it almost in your backyard, and studies have proven that this works. And that is the most important thing, because many other parts of the climate solutions, we need to work very hard on them. And I'm super supportive and I urge the world to do that. But some of them have a potential. You know, we still are working on more energy efficient transport, housing, manufacturing. And that has a big promise, but it's not yet on the doorstep. Well, this one, the natural climate solution, better, more sustainable agriculture and sustainable forests, we know that it works. And I think that is the main thing that gives me hope that this will work and that it will also convince policymakers to support it.
Fantastic. That is a great insight to kind of close out the conversation. Mike, let me ask you, I want to ask you for final thoughts here and what we've learned from Han today. Where do you think this integrates from your background and your scope moving forward?
I wish I could be as hopeful as Han. I think that it's absolutely imperative to have this system level thinking as far as policy goes and as far as supply chain goes for publicly and privately traded companies. But on the whole, if it's going to be a market-driven solution to a lot of these environmental issues, it's going to take a paradigm shift, especially in this country, known as a throwaway society. People will lose the irony of having the last straw, where the straw movement, or get rid of plastic bags, and it's. I think those are very great and very symbolic environmental causes. But the fact is, when you come out of the grocery store and you have 40 pounds of packaging in your cart, that millimeter of plastic isn't going to be what's killing the polar bears. So I think it's really coming to grips with the fact that we have to change how we think from education and childhood all the way up through of what do we actually need to sustain our lives and get away from just growing the amount of goods and material goods we have. I think it really becomes experiences, not stuff. Yeah. And I think that's kind of where it has to go.
That's good. I mean, absolutely, Mike. I think that's great advice from both of you. And I'll just kind of advocate for all of that. I mean, really, the only solution we have is between the ears, right? It's got to be a shift. I mean, we're only a generation away, which is exciting, but we're only a generation away, so we got to get on it. And I'll just, you know, Han, it was wonderful to hear you speak about this, and I think some of your analogies will resonate with our listeners. Your comparison to the hourglass shape of supply and those bottlenecks tied to there, but really, how you can engage those strategic enablers, those big brands who control much of that, is the essential step, and how we can press those big brands to be part of this solution as buyers. And the fact that you have 20,000 Rainforest Alliance products is very impactful. And it gives us the ability as consumers that we can share that burden with the farmers to do our part, as you said. And it's exciting when we do look at this, that this all works, right? If we connect with natural systems instead of only trying to control them, the capacity is in our hands to be better shepherds, better land managers. So,
no doubt.
Han, I thank you so much for taking the time to share such wisdom with our listening audience. I learned a great deal today. Mike?
Absolutely, Han. Have a wonderful holiday. And we thank you for taking the time out of your Friday to talk to us.
Thank you. Same to you. Enjoy your holidays.
Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.